The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone. The views and opinions expressed are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent KCBQ or its sponsors. It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you find that people who embrace the supernatural experiences of the Bible often dismiss other kinds of experiences, such as visits from ghosts, specifically departed friends. We'll discuss this provocative subject today. I am also honored to interview Terry Kelhock, who wrote a controversial and stimulating novel about the religion of Islam. Very small in the news today. Maybe you've heard of Islam, maybe you haven't, but we will get to all these items on a very full show. But first, the latest news. Well, it happened. Against tremendous odds, Christine O'Donnell defeated longtime staple congressman Michael Castle in the Delaware Republican primary for senator. And now, communicators like Karl Rove and Charles Krauthammer, both of whom I respect, actually, are scolding the Tea Party movement, claiming it may have ruined our chances to take back the Senate this November by supporting a candidate who cannot possibly win. Well, putting aside the fact that many already predicted O'Donnell would not win the primary either, just for argument's sake, because I think she can win, but just for argument's sake, let me stipulate. Yes, as a general rule, whether they be moderate Republicans or conservative Republicans, it is necessary to nominate the candidate who can actually win, especially this year when retaking Congress is more important than ever before in the history of our country. Having said that, may I humbly suggest that the time for such a discussion is over because the primary is now history. Whatever people sincerely think should have happened, the fact remains, hello, Christine O'Donnell did get the nomination. Deal with it. It is time for conservatives to come together. Instead of complaining that the poor woman can't win, let's just get behind this newcomer and see to it that she does win. Well, despite the O'Donnell controversy, conservatives are in near euphoria as November approaches. All reliable polls suggest that Republicans will take back the House. Some indicators even see the Senate changing hands. Assuming Obama doesn't create some crisis and find a way to blame conservatives, I am planning a celebration on election night, but only a brief one. Then we must get ready for 2012. Say what you want about our president. The man knows how to make gullible people eat out of his hand. He plays the crowd as well as he plays golf and almost as often. True, many are waking up, but these same yawning, coffee-drinking souls who elected the Pied Piper in the first place can fall under his trance again at the drop of a medicine man's hat. Consider this. If 2 years from now our economy is doing better, Obama will grab all the credit. This is just exactly what happened when Bill Clinton was reelected after 2 years of a Republican House-Senate takeover. To this day, Democratic talking points boast of the great economy George Bush inherited from Clinton. Republicans get no congratulations whatsoever. Indeed, then Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich was vilified by periodicals such as Time Magazine with their shameless but effective cover story, The Gingrich Who Stole Christmas. Ironically, the greedy capitalist politics of Gingrich are the exact same policies Clinton took a bow for. It staggers the imagination. What do people remember, however? Gingrich the greedy and Clinton the fiscally wise. Watch for a remake of this motion picture should Republicans reclaim Congress and rescue our evaporating economy. On the other hand, if things have not turned around 2 years from now, and it's such a mess, who knows if it will turn around 2 years from now. If it turns around or does not turn around, Obama has the perfect scapegoat. If you thought he enjoyed playing his favorite George Bush wild card, just wait until you hear all those tear-jerking speeches about the mean, nasty, non-cooperating Republicans refusing to even consider his compassionate Marxist ideas. Heck, he blames them even now for what he can't accomplish, even though Republicans have zero voting power. Last week, I talked about Obama's new mantra, Republicans are the party of no. Liberals are great at these mindless yet successful head-jamming methods. True, such romper room-style tactics treat adults like children, but what can I say? Much as we wish people would use their heads and actually think for themselves, human beings tend to activate their votes before activating their brains. All last week, the current Republican leadership was going back and forth about how much to cooperate with the forthcoming tax vote. They come across as desperate men trying in vain to avoid the title partisan, as if that meant something other than standing by a true heartfelt conviction, and as if Democrats were not the most partisan species ever to grace our fair planet. I must strongly urge any Victorian Republican politician to be savvy yet uncompromising after they take back Congress. Many, not all, but many Republicans are notorious for standing by their values while running for office or holding down the fort as the minority party. Then once they take full control, that taste of power tickles the tongue and they turn complacent. They worry more about what the New York Times editorial page will write about them than what the very people who put them in office expect. Will Republicans want to be criticized for repealing our marvelous, compassionate health care? Will they be able to handle the false but sure to be used title racist and bigot for reasserting anti-terrorist policies and confronting radical Islam head on? Are they going to stand their ground about tax cuts and spending cuts despite the lie that being frugal means they only care about rich people? Can senators and congressmen stomach being painted as uncooperative, even when they know deep inside that to refuse cooperation with our present course might just be the only action which saves America from disaster? Do they realize the mainstream media will, with Obama's help, paint them as demons no matter what they do, so they may as well just do what is right? Have they finally figured that out? Just do what is right? Make no mistake, my friends, 2010 is only a prologue, like that smaller book entitled The Hobbit. Tolkien's first novel was nothing without his more important tale, The Lord of the Rings. 2012 will be a festival or a funeral. It all hinges upon our Republican politicians trying something new and novel for a change, discontinuing politics. If only we could send Sam and Frodo to Washington. Alas, Mount Doom was probably easier. If you'd like to weigh in on any of this, call in toll-free number 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach me, questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions at bobsiegel, SIEGEL.net. And we're on Facebook, and we're on Twitter. We slice, we dice. Concerning my comments a few weeks back about courts ruling it unconstitutional to have a burial cross on public land because somebody might think that means Christianity is a state religion. It's not a state religion, but if they think that, then we have to make laws based on what people think. Well, Jim writes and tells me, the Christian cross made tyrants nervous 2,000 years ago, son of a gun. It still does. The Nazarene carpenter had a unique message, and it still brings hope to those who love freedom and life. Concerning the comments I made on last week's program about Time Magazine, Larry in Spring Valley says, Bob, I feel the same way toward U.S. News & World Report, which I discovered some 20 years ago, prior to which I subscribed to Time or Newsweek. After reading an issue of U.S. News & World Report, which reported both sides of an issue and left the conclusion to me, I said to myself, so this is what journalism is supposed to be. Unfortunately, U.S. News & World Report has in the meantime succumbed to the PC and has become as biased as most current print media. I will soon cancel my subscription. Thanks for the reminder. Regarding my comments that I made just a few moments ago about moderate versus conservative Republicans, Evie in San Diego says, with God, all things are possible. Well, I'm with you so far, Evie. Evie goes on to say, I'm sure you totally disagree with me, But I do not agree that we should vote for the one that can or could win. How many times do we have to walk through the desert because we fail to follow God's laws? The lesser of two evils leaves you with just that. I support O'Donnell. Look at all the ones that have stepped up to the plate because we have spineless, self-serving men in office. Several candidates have served on the front lines to fight for our liberties and come home to find that we have and are going to be giving these liberties away. So now they are taking up the battle and running for office to save us from ourselves. And I certainly won't vote for Meg, so we'll leave that slot blank. Jerry Brown was a piece of work years ago and still is. God have mercy on us. Well, indeed, God have mercy on us. Evie, I appreciate where you're coming from. I really do. None of us like to vote for the lesser of two evils. Consider this, though, Evie, just something to think about. If it's a choice between the lesser of two evils or the greater of two evils, what do we want to pick? Now, on this subject, Maureen on Facebook says, we have been voting for the candidate that was electable, quote unquote, for a long time now, and the Democrats have controlled Congress since the 2006 elections. It is time to vote your conscience, which is what got O'Donnell elected, she says. It got Reagan elected, too. Patty on Facebook, looking at her comments, says, so, agree, Maureen and Bob? Well, since you asked, Patty, I kind of agree. I kind of don't agree. It depends on the situation. In general, I think the primary is the tool to get the rhino out of there. For you new people, rhino means Republican in name only. I think the primary is the time to get the rhino out of there. In the general election, the thing to consider is this. Even a rhino will count in the grand scheme of things as a Republican, and then Republicans can take back the House and the Senate, and then hopefully the majority of them will be conservative. Many conservatives decided to punish the Republicans by not voting in the last two elections. What was the result? They gave control to the Democrats. Was it worth it? Well, some say it's worth it because it's giving the country a taste for what Democrats can actually do. But they have nearly destroyed our country. And even if we take back Congress in November, it will be difficult to reverse all the damage. And then there was the time Republicans punished George Bush Sr. for raising taxes. And yes, he deserved to be punished. But they punished him by not voting or going for Perot. The result, 8 years of Bill Clinton. Was it worth it? Now, having said that, I also believe that the more conservative candidate will do better in the election anyway, especially with the current backlash and climate. I was merely saying to those who think the less qualified one, so be it if that's what you think. Bottom line, she is the nominee. Get behind her. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net.
Welcome back to our program. I'm going through some of your email questions sent directly to me by email and others that I've been getting on Facebook regarding my warning of how Obama will exploit a Republican Congress. Renee says, government is in a perpetual state of transition. However, if when the pendulum swings in the conservative direction, example, post-November 2010 elections, you can look for Barack Hussein Obama to start issuing one executive order after another, bypassing Congress altogether. After all, doesn't he think he's the czar? Well, I wish I didn't agree with you, Renee, but I'm forced to agree. He seems to hold democracy in contempt, and in his arrogance, he believes he knows better than the rest of us what we truly need. On that same subject, Deborah says, good points to think on. I especially like your apt comparison of 2010 to Tolkien's first novel. Deborah also says, you give voice to our anger and disgust. I really appreciate it. And regarding last week's show about the Quran burnings, or the burnings that never happened but then caused American flag burnings all over the world, and other fun news in the Muslim world, Deborah says, thanks, Bob. Great show. And I like disclaimer Dan. Well, we like him too. And boy, do we need disclaimer Dan with all the comments I make. Regarding my comments last week about Obama calling Republicans the party of no, Mike in Champaign, Illinois says, I hope other people can actually think this way too. I confess, as much as everyone thinks the Dems are out in November, I'm not at all sure. Well, Mike, they are out in November unless, and it's a significant unless Obama creates a crisis and blames it on conservatives. From Diana in El Cajon, I have a very interesting question, and this is the one that I kind of tickled your appetite with at the top of our program. She says, hi, Bob. I have a very good friend who told me about this incident that happened to her about 20 years ago, and I was just thinking about it the other day. I wanted to know what you would say. She was very good friends with a man in a business relationship. She read in the paper that he died, but the paper did not go into details of his death. She called his office, and they would not release any info of his death. She was getting ready to leave to go somewhere and was in her vanity room when she felt a presence, and she looked down beside her. She saw an arm and a hand going around her to hug her. She then looked to the other side and saw the same thing. She was not scared because it was not threatening. The arms were of a man with a white dress shirt on and a navy blue jacket. The sight went away, but a few minutes later, she felt a strange headache in the back of her head. She had to sit down. It hurt so bad. Then she thought of her friend who had just died and remembered his hands. His hands looked just like the ones that she was just seeing going around her. She called and told her cousin, who told her it was him and that he was saying goodbye. She had her cousin call his office to see if she could get any more. Continuing with this email question from Diane, her cousin found out that he had a seizure while he was in the shower and hit the back of his head very hard when he fell. She later called and confirmed this information. She told me about this at the time 20 years ago. I believed her because she is very honest and realistic. But the churches I have attended have taught me that your soul goes to heaven as soon as you die and that you cannot come back to say or give messages. What is your take on this? P.S. Congratulations on having the number one blog on Town Hall. Well, thank you, Diane, and it wouldn't have happened without faithful readers like you. But as for your question, as a matter of fact, the Bible does have, not many, but some examples of people being visited by those who passed on. One obvious one in the New Testament, Moses and Elijah met with Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration, although technically Elijah had not died, but was raptured into heaven without experiencing death. Moses had a physical death, though. He was there as well. So yes, those who passed on could return for a visit. However, and Diana and everybody listening, this is extremely important. If God wants to send someone to do that, that's fine. It does not work the other way. Or let me put it this way. It is forbidden the other way. Going the other direction, God strictly forbids any proactive communication with the dead. He forbids seances, Ouija boards, or any kind of sorcery. Now, there's many places in Scripture, but one that jumps to mind is Deuteronomy chapter 18. In such cases, we may very well find ourselves talking to a demon impersonating our loved ones. And that actually happened to me before I became a Christian. These are some words I spoke to my own mother when I was a senior in high school. I said, Mom, brace yourself. I know this is going to be hard for you to believe, but Jane is still alive. Honestly, she is. Her spirit exists, and I actually talked to her. It was late at night. I had returned home from an evening with my friends. Never had my mother looked so startled, and never would she have expected such words to come out of my mouth. Jane was my 21-year-old sister, and she had recently died in a car accident after having been disowned by my dad, who never got along with her and who finally kicked her out of the house for good. Now I was telling my mom that Jane's ghost was alive, my mom, who had raised me as an atheist. Not only had I grown up without God, I didn't believe in anything supernatural at all. In fact, I was cocky, arrogant high school senior, and the only reason I accidentally stumbled into this bizarre-sounding experience is because I was at a wild drama cast party. I heard that a few people were messing around with a Ouija board upstairs, and I went up there with a few wisecracking buddies to laugh at these naive, gullible, idiots who believed in fairy tales. Well, when the evening was over, none of us were laughing anymore. We saw some things we couldn't explain. Through the Ouija board and later on through an actual seance, we communicated with a spirit who claimed to be Jane. This spirit said things about our family that were private that nobody outside our family could possibly have known. The spirit said she was the guardian angel of our family, but only mother's side. She was acknowledging her bad relationship with my dad that nobody there knew about. One woman even got possessed at the seance, turned to my brother, and cried out, "Paul, be good. Paul, be good." This was something June used to say to Paul all the time. All right, now a few years later, I became a Christian. I renounced this occult activity. Let me say that again. After I became a Christian, I renounced this occult activity because I learned that I had not, in fact, talked to my sister Jane, but rather a demon who was impersonating her in the hopes of getting me obsessed with the supernatural. Such obsession could have eventually led to demon possession. Now, ironically, seeing the supernatural, even though it was an evil, deceptive supernatural, seeing the supernatural convinced me that there must be some kind of God. It just shows how good God is. By God's grace, and only His grace, I ended up with Jesus Christ, and I want to warn everybody who's listening that Satan has 1,000 masks, 1,000 exciting, warm, and fuzzy experiences. He wants to keep you from the miraculous work of the real God in your life, and he knows that the best place to hide a tree is in a forest. But we must not be fooled. His path is the path of destruction. Any supernatural power apart from Jesus comes from Satan. Let me say that again. Any supernatural power apart from Jesus comes from Satan. Does that sound closed-minded of me, folks? There's no such thing as facts unless we eventually examine the data and make a decision. And if that's called closing the mind, so be it. Sometimes something may look good. Sometimes it may feel good, but the source is Satan. Now, while we're on the subject of sorcery, a very interesting question was submitted by Nils, who writes us from time to time. Nils in Spring Valley. Now, I don't always agree with Nils, but I like him. He's a very bright guy who thinks outside the box. That's something I always appreciate, even when I don't come to the same conclusions. And Nils makes points that others don't always think to make. Well, in relation to the whole Quran book burning controversy that I talked about on the High Majority of the show last week, specifically my objection to the book burning, despite a very personal, critical view of the Quran itself, Nils writes, "Bob, I am hearing about Christians being condemnatory of burning any book. I am not sure, but that seems to conflict with the tone of Acts 19:19. I think that there are some books that should be burned." Well, I appreciate that point. Nils, let me respond. You raise a very interesting area with the Acts 19 passage. Let me read that. "A number who had practiced sorcery," so this brings us back to the subject of sorcery, "a number who had practiced sorcery brought their scrolls together and burned them publicly. When they calculated the value of the scrolls, the total came to 50,000 drachma." Well, now, in the book of Acts, people were bringing their own books to be burned as a way of personally repenting from involvement with supernatural power that they now knew came from Satan, the deceiver, who once again counterfeits the miracles of God in hopes that people will be lost in a sea of confusion, and that makes it easier for him to gain control of their souls. Now, I did something very similar to these ancients when I first became a Christian. I told you that I was involved in the occult. Well, before giving my life to Jesus, it wasn't just these seances. I owned several occult-type books, including horoscopes, all that kind of stuff. I did not burn them, but after I became a Christian, I did tear them up. I did throw them away. I don't regret that. It was my way of renouncing them. I did this privately and only with my own property, I should say. It was not vandalism. That is a bit different than burning a book merely as a method of public protest, at least in our current culture, when book burning tends to be equated with censorship. As a Christian, I always defend the free speech of others, and in doing so, defend my right to counter their positions. Serving as a campus minister at UC Santa Barbara and UC San Diego in the 1980s was quite the interesting experience. All kinds of nutjob cults made their way to our colleges sooner or later. From time to time, I was invited to sign petitions, often at the instigation of other evangelical student organizations, to throw these pressure groups off campus. I got to tell you, I refused. I refused because I knew that if we did not protect freedom of speech for everybody, it would sooner or later come back to bite us on our own Bibles. How's that for a quick replacement? After all, many people believe Christianity itself to be a cult. Sure, they're wrong. It's not a cult. They're wrong. But who's going to make those kinds of subjective, arbitrary decisions if we don't simply allow legally all people to talk, no matter how false or dangerous we deem their words? Now, in some ways, I was a double-edged sword, the guy who protected the rights of those who disagreed with them, but also the same pest who argued with them at their outdoor book tables while many others stood by and watched. This kind of free speech genuinely contrasts the love and truth of Jesus with the bondage and falsehood of pseudo-gods. At the end of the day, rather than burning the Quran, I would prefer that people read and understand just exactly what is in the Quran. An honest, literal comprehension of this text may just be the best way to protect our country from those who would put its words on red alert. Well, speaking of the Quran, I have a very special guest who actually wrote a novel about the Quran. The last time somebody tried that, it was a guy named Salman Rushdie, and he got into a lot of trouble. So she's a very brave woman. In fact, she's brave enough to be in the studio even as we talk. I'm going to introduce her when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539, W&S Electric.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Welcome back to our program. Terry Kelhock. I almost called her Carrie. There are a lot of Carries. This is a Terry. Terry Kelhock's book, Top Copy Secret, is scheduled for release on September the 21st, so we're jumping the gun a little bit. It's already set off a firestorm of controversy. Terry Kelhock, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me, Bob. Great to be here.
I'm hearing a little bit of interference, Todd. You know what that is? I'm hearing some interference behind me. Anyway, I'm sure they can understand us, so go ahead and look into that, Todd. I'm hearing it right through my earphones. Terry, it's nice to have you here. Now, tell us about this book that you've written.
Well, Bob, The Top Copy Secret is a high-stakes adventure that starts in America, goes across Europe and through many exciting sites there and into the Middle East, where it brings attention to great places in the Middle East and Middle Eastern culture. Meanwhile, our hero and heroine are trying to escape people that don't want them to deliver the message they have discovered.
Okay. Now, I guess the obvious question, I mentioned this before we went to the break, when Salman Rushdie wrote the book, The Satanic Verses, there was immediately a fatah put out on him. I'm sure people in the audience are thinking this. Weren't you afraid to write a book like this?
Frankly, I did have to think about that a long time, but some of the ideas that gave me courage are thinking about reporters over in Iraq and investigative reporters, people who all the time take risks to bring a fact or a cover-up to life of something they think is very important. And when I came across this contradiction between what the party line of Islam is and what I found out in my research, I thought, wow, this is something that the general public does have a right to know.
Okay. So you're somebody who stands by her convictions because you thought the public had a right to know it. Now, some would say, for example, I know your book's been compared to The Da Vinci Code. Now, I've read The Da Vinci Code, and The Da Vinci Code was an excellent novel, but full of all kinds of historical falsehoods. So I think sometimes people are going to look at this, and even if you have facts in there, they might say, well, it's only a novel after all. What do you think? How are you convincing them that even though this is a novel, obviously you're writing a novel to draw them in, how would you want them to come away understanding that it's also the truth? Do you have something at the beginning of the book that says?
Absolutely. Yeah. That makes it distinctive from The Da Vinci Code. In fact, I didn't set out to write a novel about the Quran, about Islam at all. I was drawn into it over time because of what I discovered. And I thought, this is actually out there. You don't have to scratch very hard under the surface to see that the Quran has been changed. If you actually look into it, all you have to do is read the Muslim sources themselves or read some of the easily available academic sources.
Give us an example of some of the things that have been changed in the Quran, because I know that to Muslims, those are real fighting words. They say the Bible's been changed, which actually isn't true, but they say the Bible's been changed and the Quran has not been changed.
Right. Actually, even saying that the Quran has been changed, those are fighting words. They don't know this. The average Muslim has no idea of the process that the Quran went through.
Why don't we walk back? If you don't mind, let's step back and talk to our audience like they're third graders. And let's just start with Muhammad. Muhammad allegedly heard the voice of God, of Allah, in a cave, never wrote anything down himself, but his disciples wrote it down. And even in Muhammad's time, things changed. For example, there were a lot of verses about peace in the Quran, but then when Muhammad discovered that through violence he had to take Mecca and places like that, by an incredible coincidence, he started getting new revelations. And don't Muslims believe that the newer revelations trump the older ones?
Absolutely. That's called abrogation. And Muhammad received revelations over time. And at the time, he didn't write them down. Some of the traditions we have called hadiths say that Muhammad didn't even want to have the traditions written down permanently. People, after Muhammad's trances, when he shared his revelations, they would write them on whatever was available at the time. Maybe it was an animal bone or a palm leaf or what was used for paper in those days. And it was actually after Muhammad's death, after supposedly the first collection under Khalif Abu Bakr, was when they noticed that many of the people who had known the words of the Quran were dying and that it needed to be put together somehow. So this is the legendary first collection of the Quran. There was a second collection after that under Uthman, Khalif Uthman. And why that one is so important is you ask me how we can have any proof of changes of the Quran. And it's very well known that Khalif Uthman standardized his own edition and burnt all the rival editions of the Quran. I actually wrote an article this past week on the Huffington Post. It talks about Quran burning past and present, and that originally the Qurans were burnt by Muslims themselves who didn't like the idea that there were variant Qurans out there.
Okay, now I have to admit, when you said Huffington Post, that just leaped out at me like a bobcat. The Huffington Post actually had an article written by you sound like your viewpoint is at least conservative at the very least.
I write for several online organizations. I also write for Fox Online, and I write for Political Mavens. So,
well, I think it's wonderful that you've got your articles in those. But they don't have a problem with that. They don't have a reputation as printing both sides, the Huffington Post, or maybe
well,
they should have a reputation.
People can read my articles and decide what they think about them. But they certainly are getting posted on the Huffington Post,
well,
where I
impressive.
Think there's an audience that maybe should hear
oh,
what,
no.
what
Good
I'm
for
having
you
to say.
And that's very impressive, and I would write for the Huffington Post in a heartbeat if I thought they would print it. But then they might read something I've written about the Huffington Post. That might kill the deal for me. But anyway, I'm very impressed that you're writing for them.
That's just one example of how the Quran has changed over time. What I have Muslims telling me in response to that is, well, there were just variants in pronunciations, and this is not the truth. There were actual variants in the words themselves. I can give you specific examples of that, but it can tend to get technical. Some of that is in my book, but one example I can give you that is very powerful that Muslims all over the world need to know.
Okay, I want to hear about this example. We're going to go to a quick break. My very special guest, Terry Kelhog, the Top Copy Secret is scheduled for release on September 21st. We will be right back. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's daily blog on townhall.com. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net. Here, you download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. BobSiegel.net. We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Welcome back to our program. I'm here with Terry Kelhock. Top Copy Secret is scheduled for release on September the 21st, a novel about the Quran. Terry was just about to tell us something that she says to Muslims that's very persuasive when she's trying to make a point. Go ahead, Terry.
All over the world, Muslims pray what's called the Fatiha. They pray it several times a day, and it's one of the most important passages to them. It's the very first surah of the Quran. What is eye-opening is when they find out that one of the few most trusted companions of the Prophet Muhammad did not accept this as even being part of the Quran. This is shocking. This is eye-opening to them because they believe it is one of the most precious parts of the Quran. But we have record of what was in the Quran of Ibn Mas'ud. This is the companion of the Prophet. And what was in his Quran was different than the current modern Quran. A lot of it was the same, but it was lacking that first important surah, which tells them basically, God, lead us in your way. Don't lead us into the way of those who have gone astray. And they pray this many times a day, but that's not even in the Quran of Ibn Mas'ud. And there were four men that Muhammad said you should get the Quran from. Trust these to be experts on the Quran. Ibn Mas'ud was one of them. Khalif Uthman, who enforced his own Quran, burnt rival Qurans and is actually to somewhat, by some Shiites, vilified because they think he removed verses that emphasized their claims that Ali should be a hereditary leader. Him, who there's much debate about, put the Fatiha in. So this is one of the huge changes and irregularities in the history of the Quran.
Now, I believe you, of course, but I'm just going to play the devil's advocate. I'm talking to a Muslim. I tell him that. He says, that's not true. You've gotten your information wrong. What do you say to that? What would be a book that you could tell this person to go to study this for themselves?
Absolutely. I didn't make this up. Terry Kelhock made up nothing about the changes in the Quran. And what is different about the Top Copy Secret and the Da Vinci Code, one of the differences is that the claims made in the story, even though it's a novel, there are claims made throughout as discoveries. Each one of those is documented in the references in the back of the book, but you don't have to buy the book. You can get it online on my website, terrykelhock.com. And we have both Shia and Sunni references that document that, for example, Khalif Uthman burnt the rival Qurans, that Ibn Mas'ud did not include the Fatiha, and exact verses that were added or subtracted from the original Quran, or maybe we don't even know what was the original Quran. Some had it and some didn't. So this is the kind of information that's coming out in the book. Even though it's a novel, these true things are included and documented.
Well, this is fascinating. So let's just retract a little bit. You eventually were just researching the Quran, and possibly you were going to write a nonfiction piece, and you used fiction just as a tool to draw people in, but it started out of a love for going out and finding the facts. You didn't wake up one morning and say, I want to write a novel and then make it conform to the facts. You started with the facts and then decided that a novel might be a way to just really increase the readership.
I started studying Islam in 1999. Before that, I had had Muslim friends and we would superficially talk about it. But in 1999, I could see that it was an important world force that needed to be understood better. So I didn't want to just believe everything anybody told me. So I thought, I'm going to go to the source. I'm going to go to mosques, Islamic institutes, campus meetings, anything I can do. And I'm also going to read their books. I'm not going to just believe what they're telling Americans on the campus. I'm going to read the original manuscript. So I bought for myself a large library of Islamic documents, the classic works that you have to have and understand to know the Sunni doctrine or the Shia doctrine. So I'm not using minute, unimportant, trivial, weak hadith. I'm using strong material. And I was researching it for myself, and then it struck me that there was this huge, to my way of thinking, cover-up between what is officially published. For example, here, this is an official publication by the Embassy of Saudi Arabia in Washington, D.C., to the American people, and it says right in here, not one word of its 114 chapters has been changed over the centuries.
Now, do you think they know the truth, or do you think they're deliberately being deceptive?
What I have found is both goes on. Most, like maybe 95% or more of Muslims, believe this. And it's sincerely one of their most precious beliefs. And they think that that is a proof that Islam is true because, to their way of thinking, all the other holy books in the world have changed, especially the ones from monotheistic religions. But that finally, God had the ability to protect his word, and that the Quran has never changed. I have references in the Quran that say this, and then I have references in other Islamic forces, such as from the Embassy in Saudi Arabia, that tell people that. And many Americans are taking that at face value without taking the time to research it. But I'm one of the compulsive Americans that actually did research, and I found out, wow, you don't have a basis to say this on. And I've been to the debates, and I've heard how the Muslims defend it. The Muslim defenders, they can't really, when they're confronted with the details, the experts in Islam who know the truth will often have to admit it. But they will either say, well, that doesn't count as a change, or they will say, okay, yes, we agree all this happened. We agree that there was a portion of the surah that was eaten after Muhammad died and everything was crazy. But that's okay because Allah wanted it that way. For example, you may have heard recently they're trying to stone a woman in Iran. That's based on what used to be in the Quran, according to testimonies that we have. But those verses were eaten after Muhammad died, and they were under Aisha's bed. And in the confusion, she said they were eaten, but they're still in practice.
Well, and there's still in a lot of the codes and the Sharia laws of a lot of country, even if the verses have been taken out of the Quran. Isn't that true? These kinds of laws that I know that in some countries, if a woman is even seen in public with somebody who's not a relative, she could be stoned to death.
A Sharia law is based on the Quran and the traditions.
Right. So it sounds like some of those verses that they took out of the Quran have remained in Sharia law.
They can remain in practice. There are several types of abrogation. You asked me, why is it there are some peaceful verses, and did Muhammad's later revelations cancel his earlier ones? And that's the general understanding. It's not always admitted, especially in America, but you've got a big problem with the Quran, because there are very beautiful, peaceful verses, not many, but there are, and yet you have these other ones which basically say anyone who doesn't believe in Allah and Muhammad is a kafir, is an infidel, and all the infidels should be killed. So how do you put that together?
Yeah, either they contradict themselves, which makes it unlikely that it came from God, or one trumps the other, which means it's now meant to be a more violent book. So it's not painting a great picture either way. Now, to their credit, and I'm sure both of us would agree, there are many nominal Muslims, people who grew up in Muslim countries, they're either unfamiliar with the verses of the Quran or they've found ways to reinterpret them. I remember after 9/11, a Muslim doctor said that for him, a jihad was fighting against bacteria and fighting against disease. And that sounds really nice, but that's not what Muhammad meant.
There is that kind of jihad, but if you talk to people from the Middle East, which I do all the time, and part of how I could write a book so based in Islamic culture is because I have many personal and professional connections with it. If you ask people from the Middle East, what is jihad? Mostly they will say it is violent jihad, the struggle. And in the actual Quran I have here, which is English and Arabic from Saudi Arabia, it says directly in it that jihad was imposed. Originally, there was a more peaceful situation or to encourage people to believe, but in the end they did have to encourage actual fighting, and that's in the commentary at the back. So
Regarding your own credentials, I know that Terry Kellogg is your pen name, and that's wise of you to have a pen name. So without giving away anything about your biography or naming any institution, your professional background and qualifications would be what?
I have a doctorate degree, and I don't claim that is in Islamic studies. It isn't. But I see that as a strength, because what I'm doing is taking a complicated subject and distilling it down into facts that people can understand. I do have Islamic scholars that back me up, and of course they're given in the references as well. So I don't think you have to be a PhD in Islam to do this. I also have done a lot of teaching at the university level, and as I said, I have lots of connections with the Middle East and Islam.
Are you still able to get into the university these days with things being so PC? It would seem that a lot of universities wouldn't want anything adverse about the Quran to even be mentioned.
If you're talking, do I go in there waving a flag saying I'm Terry Kellogg, author of the Top Copy Secret? But most of them are open campuses. You can walk in and talk to people, and I do that.
That's interesting. Now, I know that a lot of Muslims will say if you haven't read the Quran in Arabic, you haven't really read it. But now you mentioned it's very interesting that there are Muslim scholars who will back you up. Obviously, they have read it in Arabic.
Of course, they're experts in it. They are very much experts, trained in the Middle East, Arabic speakers. And yes, they are. But as far as reading the Quran in Arabic, in many of the traditions, most of the traditions, you want to gain favor with Allah. And reading the Quran, each letter that you read, depending on the purity of your pronunciation, is worth between 10 and 40 good deeds. Maybe some say up to 60 at certain times of the year. So you want to read the Arabic, that. And you also want to read it in the original Arabic, because that's where the power is. And the difference between the Quran and other holy books is, to some degree, the whole Quran is seen as a mantra. In fact, one woman who grew up in Islam recently told me it's like a spell. The whole Quran is like a spell. It's like a hypnotic.
That's interesting, because I've read it not in Arabic, but I have read the Quran, and it is very poetic and rhythmic in its nature.
This is one of the things that fascinates Arabic speakers with it, is it is in this kind of an Arabic. So they feel that you need to read it in that language in order to have the power, and because you are getting points in heaven for what you read here. This is what makes it so devastating that we don't know what is in the original Quran, if there was an original Quran. We know that the dots and dashes that make the vowels were added later, around 300 years later, than the original backbone script of the Quran. This may sound a bit in detail. Of course, I explain it better in the book. But why that's important is, if we don't know what the letters in the Quran are, and we are Muslims praying, and we're even doing it in Arabic, we are supposed to be praying what is preserved on the tablet in heaven. That's what gives us points in order to go to heaven and eternal life. If we don't know what those words are, how do we know what we're getting credit for?
Very interesting. Now, so let's back up a little bit. You would say that the vast majority of the Muslims are very sincere, and they're unaware of how their book has been rewritten. But some are aware, and they're being deceptive. Now, isn't it true that they have kind of a license from Muhammad? Because I know that in the hadith, he said that under certain circumstances, war being one of them, it is actually okay to lie to your enemy. So wouldn't it be true that we have some nominal Muslims who really are peaceful and not thinking about the jihad, but at the same time, we might have other Muslims who claim to be moderate and claim to be peaceful, but it might be a deception, that we have both kinds?
Absolutely. And we want to encourage moderate Muslims to stay that way.
You bet. It's kind of like we don't want to give them too many lessons on accurate literary criticism because it'll come back to haunt us. Yeah.
Right. I have found when the point is put on it, even with, for example, I was talking to one student from Saudi Arabia. We were at an interfaith event and just talking about different issues. When it came up that the Quran was changed, the student got very vehement, of course, that it hadn't been. The professor was in the room, and the student said, "Let me bring over the professor, and you can talk to the professor about it." When I spoke to the professor in front of the student at the end of a course in Islam, a university course in Islam, the student had never heard once about the development of the Quran and the changes in the Quran. But when faced with me, the professor had to admit in front of that student that, yes, and said basically, yes, of course the Quran has been changed. You can imagine how the student took it, because that student was a victim of almost a cover-up, a major thing that they had never heard about, even in the university, even in growing up in an Islamic culture.
Well, and that happens sometimes with naive Christians too, which is my area of expertise, that sometimes I'll meet a Christian who thinks that the manuscripts of the Bible are the originals, and I'll have to tell them that there are copies. I don't think that's quite the same problem, because we have thousands of copies, and the more copies you have, the more it increases the likelihood that it's of proximity to the original. But that does happen. There can be a disparity between those that are scholars and actually know these sacred texts and then the person that's just following along. So we need to extend some grace. A lot of the Muslims that we meet, folks who say the Quran's a peaceful book and it's a perfect book and it hasn't been rewritten, a lot of them are saying that sincerely, and yet we also need to be wise, because some of them know better and they feel they have a license from Allah to be deceptive. So it kind of works both ways.
And there's a book called Reliance of the Traveler. It's a Sunni book. It also says that that you can not tell the truth under certain conditions. And it's not just Shia. Shia, we, of course, everyone has heard of Taqiyya, probably, who listens to your station, but we have this also in Sunni. And even more powerful than that, we have in Surah 5, verse 101, a call to the believers that says, do not even ask a question about something that would cause you to doubt.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I know one of the other conditions, one was war. When are Muslims not at war can be a very relevant question. But another one that Muhammad gave was when you need to lie to your wife. So you feminists who are always out there defending Islam as the politically correct religion, I would think you'd be a little more concerned for your own rights. Well, Terry, we've talked a lot about the Quran, which obviously is the purpose of your book. But I want to give you an opportunity to tell the audience a little bit about the story of your novel, too. So let's swing this back to somebody goes and buys your novel. What can they expect?
Thanks. They don't even have to be interested in Islam. So the book is an interesting hybrid of nonfiction and fiction, but the fiction part is really a lot of fun, and we're getting great reviews for people who love it because it travels to these exotic settings and there's a lot of action. Someone who read, I have a sample chapter on RT Book Reviews that came out a couple of days ago. Someone who read it who said, actually, I felt like I was there. They just enjoyed the action scene so much. So it does have a lot of action scenes in places and with kinds of action that are different than you might see because it's in the Middle East.
And probably interesting characters that we care about that draw us right in.
The characters are Muslim. They're very engaging. They're a little different than we have in the usual American novel. I tried to write the novel so when an American reads it, they will feel like an American wrote it. And when a Middle Easterner reads it, they will feel like a Middle Easterner wrote it, that it's got a little bit of bicultural feel to
it. Well, I have to say that I find historical fiction my favorite art form, because it's just a great history lesson. Some of us have had interesting teachers, and for every interesting one, we probably got somebody who bored us to death and gave us a fascinating obsession for looking at the clock and hoping the class would be over. But then you look at books like Herman Wolk and The Winds of War and Leon Uris and Exodus that just or Gore Vidal and Lincoln. You can't ask for a better way to learn, and yet it's entertaining and it's exciting and it's riveting. Now, have you written other novels too, or is this your first?
This is the first novel that Terry Kelhock has written.
Okay, and what other books under the name of Terry Kelhock can people find?
They can just find things online under the sources I've talked about.
Okay.
And on my website too, I have additional things that I've written. The book isn't exactly historical fiction. It talks about the early days of Islam, but it is contemporary. And I think you're right, we can learn through novels. One of my writing teachers was Angela Hunt, and she says, I've learned a lot through novels. So I don't see why people can't learn through fiction. And that's what we're hoping. The things I wrote about for Islam are very easy to find, but people don't usually pay attention to it because it's in these boring nonfiction books. But now that it's in a novel, it's very approachable and easy. And I hope that they will enjoy the story as well as learning about the origin and protection of the Quran.
Okay, in the few minutes we have left, you seem like a Renaissance woman. What are other subjects that have interested you and that you have written about?
Absolutely. I love science and art and architecture and history. You will see a lot of this coming out in the book, as well as geography, languages. There are little bits of many languages in the book. So it's a very broad-based book for somebody who likes cultural things like the Da Vinci Code and stories like that, and action like James Bond. You will love it.
I actually wanted to ask you, I was curious if your take on the Da Vinci Code was similar to mine. I didn't think the guy knew history any better than the back of his shoe, and yet I did find it a page-turner. I felt that if I had to grade the Da Vinci Code artistically, I'd give him an A+. If I had to grade it for accuracy, I think he got an F-. I didn't know if you had a similar read on the Da Vinci
Code. I did read it, and I don't think accuracy was necessarily what was that important. Where in my case, absolutely every little detail has to be perfectly documented because I know my critics will be picking on it.
All right. Terry Kilhock, the book again is The Top Copy Secret. It's scheduled for release on September the 21st. It's already getting fantastic reviews. This is a courageous woman who's going only by her pen name, and we really appreciate you coming. And Terry, I hope you'll honor us by coming on our program again sometime.
Thanks so much.
Okay, this is Bob Siegel. We will see you next week. You are always welcome. Your questions are welcome too.
Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.